On this episode of Newt's World, I've been in love with animals all of my life, and I enjoy going to zoos all over the world. In fact, one of my original childhood goals was to be a zoo director. I've been fortunate enough to visit some of the most incredible zoos, as well as go on safari in Africa. I confess that before I decided to go into public service, I was going to be either a zoo director or a vertebrate paleontologist. But I ended up just trying to work on the country's problems. But my guest today considered a career in public service. We almost swapped. And then he became a zoo director. But he's much more than that. We were fortunate enough to meet years ago when Dr. Terry Maple became president and CEO of Zoo Atlanta in 1984 under Mayor Andrew Young. He then went on to lead the Palm Beach Zoo. At the time Dr. Maple took over Zoo Atlanta in 1984, the zoo had become, quote, a national disgrace following this mysterious death of an elephant uncovered in a shallow grave in North Carolina. Twinkles, the elephant, became the poster pachyderm for zoo mismanagement, and it was then that Mayor Young turned to Dr. Maple. What Dr. Maple was able to do with Zoo Atlanta was nothing short of remarkable. He's the author of 14 books, including one I co-authored with him entitled A Contract with the Earth. He has a new book he's working on now, coming out this September, which describes the incredible story of Willie B. It's entitled Atlanta's Iconic Ape, The Life of Willie B. I'm pleased to welcome my guest, Dr. Terry Maple. Terry, thank you for joining me. I wanted to do this episode because I wanted to emphasize how important I think zoos are for society and frankly make the case of why zoos matter. You have been one of the leading advocates of the importance of zoos, both as a place that families go to, as a place that practices conservation, and as a center of education. Could you talk to us for a minute or two about the degree to which zoos really, really matter?
Well, their educational function is tremendous if the school systems take advantage of it. You have to work together with them to develop a curricula that work. But a visit to the zoo is just full of learning ops. At the same time, it's a conservation organization. Now more than ever before, zoos are not only breeding endangered species and growing their populations and no longer taking animals out of the wild, but they're trying to restore habitat, trying to protect populations in the wild, and they're becoming partners with conservation organizations, spending lots and lots of money to help. And they are also centers of science. We now have this thing called One Medicine. And One Medicine is the combination of animal and human medicine, because as we have learned, sadly, these viruses don't stay on one host. They frequently jump, especially when you destroy the population that harbored the virus. It then looks for a place to jump, and that place is often humanity. This is how we believe COVID got where it is. Hantavirus, the same. There are many viruses that, like Ebola, which were in Africa for years and years, attacking animals and now attacking people. So we're all connected. And it's important that zoos and universities talk to each other, work together, continue to discover what it is about the world we need to know. But there's one other use of zoos that people don't completely understand yet, and that is that zoos are that naturalistic wildlife experience that we crave, particularly those of us who live in an urban environment. If you're an urban kid, you long to get out into nature. And zoos are nature. We feel better when we can actually revitalize and restore our sense of well-being when we go to a place like that. So zoos need to cater to this feeling. And that's how architects began to develop the so-called soft architecture and landscape immersion, building facilities that made you feel more and more like you were in nature. You don't feel good when you go in and feel like you're in prison. That's what zoos used to be like. Today's zoos are inspiring places because they mimic nature.
And they also attract a surprisingly large number of people.
They do. It's going to be interesting now that we've had this viral experience, because zoos are having to reinvent themselves. Every public place is having to reinvent itself. But zoos have the unique advantage that they are outdoor experiences. So they're safer just by that alone. But we're going to have to make do with social distancing and cleanliness standards we didn't have before. We may not be able to put people in a giant auditorium shoulder to shoulder like we used to do. Disney's probably going to lead the way on this, but we'll work with all the zoos in America and in the world to reinvent standards that will fit the problems of the day. But the number one advantage we have is we are natural outdoor experiences, and people feel better just going to the zoo. And the more we understand how people behave and how they use these spaces, the better those spaces are going to be.
So if you don't mind, I would like to go back to your childhood, growing up in Southern California. Tell me, what helped shape you back then?
Well, I was born in L.A., East L.A., which is a very dangerous place. They didn't live there long. My parents moved me to San Diego, which was wonderful. We were living on the outskirts of San Diego, a little town called Chula Vista, 7 miles from the Mexican border, by the way. And my mother is half Hispanic, so I feel like it's my territory down there. Problem is, I never learned Spanish. I just learned how to eat Mexican food, which my mother was very good at. But it was a wonderful place to grow up, and it was a kind of a wild place. There was hills and creatures, and it was a place up in the hills called Fossil Canyon, which all the little kids knew about. And we used to go up there all the time and dig fossils. And what we didn't know is that it turned out to be one of the biggest fossil finds in the history of Southern California. And this happened years later. I sent me a clipping about Fossil Canyon. They were developing it for homes. And when they found the fossils, they had to go in there and protect them. Well, I always thought the little kid should have gotten credit for discovering that place, but it didn't happen that way. But nevertheless, we were quite proud to know it. So that was a big influence on my life, because I felt like I was an explorer. I always wanted to be an explorer. So going to the zoo, which is our principal activity as a family, my father was not wealthy, so we couldn't travel. Going to L.A. was about as far as we ever got. But I didn't like L.A., but going to the zoo was a whole lot better. We went to the zoo all the time, and it was a marvelous place. Very inspirational for a little boy, a wonderful place to develop his own curiosity.
The zoo, even today, is just, I think, amazing. When you were there, it was still basically only the downtown zoo, and they did not add the wild animal park until later on in your life. Is that right?
That's right. What happened is a place called Lion Country Safari arrived in Los Angeles, and there were 7 of these safari parks built, one of them in Georgia, in Atlanta. But the one in L.A. was wildly popular. It was based on the idea that you get in your car and you drive around and you see the animals as if you were on a real safari. And they had as many as 100 lions at that park, for example, which was quite remarkable. And when San Diego started losing attendance, they started thinking maybe we need one of these things. But they didn't want to do it the same way. They built a safari experience that was a walking experience. They did build a little train that went around the outside, but primarily it was walking around in a more naturalistic place. Nevertheless, that facility, I'm told, lost money for 10 years before it began to turn a profit. It was in the northernmost part of San Diego, Escondido. Long ways to get to. But as San Diego grew and as LA grew south, more and more homes were being built, more and more people were moving there. And pretty soon, Escondido wasn't as far away as it used to be. So the park began to succeed. But from the beginning, it was an artistic success. It was an entertainment success. It was a wonderful experience. And a lot of zoos around the country began to try to emulate it. But I think the Wild Animal Park, now called the Safari Park, is really one of the extraordinary zoo experiences you'll ever have.
They had a program called Roar and Snore, where you could go and stay out and sleep in a tent. I remember going years ago, and I thought it was such a perfectly California experience. You had white tablecloths, you had china, you had California wines. I mean, you had somebody from the zoo give you a chat in the evening. You went to bed early, and then you were awakened by the lions and other animals starting around 3 a.m. And it was brilliant showmanship on the part of the San Diego Zoo. And Cliss and I were very fortunate to have a 23-day trip in Africa with the curator of birds, who was extraordinarily knowledgeable. And it was great fun. You didn't stay at the zoo. You didn't become a zookeeper. You took that love of animals and you went off to college.
Well, it's a funny thing. I enjoyed the zoo. I enjoyed animals. But I never thought you could make a living doing that. Nobody ever told me you could actually get paid for this. So I was at that time becoming politically aware. San Diego is a conservative town. I wanted to be involved in some kind of public service. But I didn't want traditional politics. I was student body president in high school, and I already had enough misery from that to ever imagine running for office. But I thought, you know, I'd like to be a statesman. I'd like to be in the Foreign Service. I get to travel and be the explorer I wanted to be, and I get to serve my country, and this would be a good thing to do. So I went to college thinking that was going to be my career. I wanted to be an ambassador. But along the way, the Vietnam War happened. And this shook me up. I just couldn't understand why so many of my peers were dying, and almost for no very good reason. Certainly we students questioned it. We had teach-ins and we talked about it incessantly. And I began to think, you know, there's got to be some answers somewhere in this academia that I'm living in right now. So I started looking at sociology and political science, and finally discovered psychology. And then, having studied psychology, I discovered ethology, which is a sort of a sub-branch of psychology and biology. And I read a book by Comrade Lorenz called On Aggression. That book turned me around. It made me believe that I could understand why men fight if I understood why animals fought. And that took me down the road of beginning to see myself as an academic involved in trying to understand man's inhumanity to man. So you'd think I might have stopped there. I did my first book, which was a reader on human aggression, when I was still in graduate school. But I started getting so interested in the animals that I realized that they were getting inhumane treatment too. And I began to get sidetracked more and more into the animals themselves. And ultimately, I became an ambassador for wildlife. That's how it turned out. You always end up doing what you're supposed to do. I was supposed to represent somebody.
you ended up representing wildlife, but you got into that in part at the University of California, Davis, which is one of the great agricultural schools in the world. And at that point in your life, you're looking at primate behavior and lessons that we can learn as humans from watching how primates interact.
Lorenz did not study primates. Once I got into the issue of studying animals, I just had to find the animals that would make sense for me. Started with monkeys, baboons. I visited Africa to visit a former student, and that influenced me. Going to Africa really opened my eyes, and I began to see that when I had the opportunity to work at Emory University, I would be able to study the largest collection of great apes in the world. Yerkes Primate Center had gorillas, orangutans, and chimps in great numbers. And they were respected, well known for what they were doing. But when I got there and I saw the facilities, they were terrible. They were not enlightened facilities like we had at the San Diego Zoo. They were very ugly cages. And I didn't think the animals could possibly be thriving under those conditions. So I almost immediately began to think my calling was probably going to be to improve, if not eliminate, these terrible examples of what my mentor, Robert Sommer, and he was studying prisons, mental hospitals, and zoos. And he wrote a book called Tight Spaces that was very influential in my thinking. And I realized that these things could change. But I also realized that it wasn't going to happen just because of an idea. That's when I began to draw upon my storehouse of people skills. And I had that probably more than any other skill, was my ability to work with people, lead people, and to get along with people. It's interesting that that's what the great Belle Benchley, the first woman zoo director at San Diego, said about her role there. When she was made director, she had been executive secretary there for many years. And the founder of the zoo said to her, "Well, Belle, I'm retiring. It's time for you to take over. You might as well be the director. You're running everything anyway." And so she took over, but she later commented that she had no zoological skills, no special ability to run a zoo, but what she had was people skills. She could get along with people. She could get people involved. She could move everybody in the right direction, and she built a powerhouse zoo and deserves a lot of credit for it.
This ability to recruit good people, get them focused on a particular direction, and have them operate together is a really rare skill among humans.
It's a funny thing. I was always good at that. When I was in the sixth grade, my teacher took me aside at school camp, and he said to me, this was a very humbling conversation. He said, "Derek, you're not the biggest boy. You're not an athlete of any consequence. You're not mean or strong. You're not a warrior. You're a leader." And he said, "Somehow you lead these kids, they follow you, and you've got a skill that you've got to take advantage of in your life." And he wanted me to know that there was something special. And I thought about this over the years, because it was just a natural thing. Also, when I began to play sports, I had an underdog personality. I just loved getting in there with a bunch of guys that were misfits. And I always picked teams because of cohesion. I never picked them because of, you know, the skills of the guys. So I'd take my guys, and we would beat good teams all the time. It was just a matter of working together, and like you say, being a team. And also just being fearless, never believing that you can't do it. And my father, who was a laborer, always told my brother and I, he did not have a high school education. But he said, you kids, you can be whatever you want to be, but you better be good at it, or I'm not going to be happy. My older brother spent 50 years at the University of California, San Diego in the Department of Physics. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. The most brilliant, wonderful role model a boy could ever have. And, you know, it just happened that all this stuff came together. But I always remember that it started in kind of simple ways and evolved and morphed and became what it was. And it was a remarkable experience. I'm still writing and mentoring and working, but it was mighty fun when I was really in the act.
You go from UC Davis, you end up first at Emory and then at Georgia Tech. And my sense was that you were doing very well at Tech and had been recognized as an academic. And suddenly you get a call from the city of Atlanta to apply a totally different set of skills. And you do it as though you were born to it. You stepped in and from day one, you began to turn the zoo around, turn it into a great research center, a terrific urban zoo, and totally reclaimed its legitimacy in terms of accreditation. I mean, were all those just latent skills that were waiting to be called upon?
Well, they were, but also there was some planning involved. When I first got into academia, I wasn't sure whether this was the place I wanted to spend my career after 3 years at Emory. I remember Dean Palms, you may remember him. He became president of Georgia State. He told us all when we came in our first year, we were all handpicked top people in the country. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, I know you're glad to be here, but I want to tell you, your chances of getting tenure here are slim and none. They adopted the Harvard model, which was bring in great people for 3 or 4 years, and then they get rid of them, bring in more great people. That way they didn't have to pay them a lot of money. So getting tenure was indeed very difficult. So I started thinking, well, yeah, I better have something in my back pocket. Now, I had already discovered zoos and was beginning to become known as the guy who has answers about apes. So I made a deal to go on a sabbatical leave. This is after I left Emory and went to Tech. I was only at Tech 2 years and I was going on a sabbatical because Ron Forman, the young director down there, wonderful guy, really great mentor. He needed a primatologist and he wanted me to come down. He said, look, you come down and be my deputy director, interim. You don't have to stay. You don't have to leave your academic career. Just come down and do this. I need your help. And he said, you'll learn something too. So I thought, you know, I will learn a great deal about how zoos are run if I go work with this. And indeed, it was the smartest thing I ever did. Because I came back with knowledge about running a zoo that I didn't have before. So when Andrew Young asked me to come into the room with all the other experts, I knew more about it than anybody else. Even though when I took the job, I was the least experienced zoo director in the entire world.
When Mayor Young talked to you, did you have a vision of what you wanted to carry this decrepit, almost unaccredited institution, where you wanted it to go and what you dreamed it could become?
And the truth is, the day I moved to Atlanta in 1975 and I went to see the zoo, I knew immediately that this zoo had some advantages that just might make it great someday if they could get all their ducks in a row. And that advantage was a very simple thing. It was the major universities surrounding Atlanta, Georgia, Georgia State, Emory, Tech, and then three veterinary schools within an hour, Auburn, Tuskegee, and University of Georgia. And I didn't know too many city zoos that had that advantage, but you had to turn it from being a not very important attraction to being a fine zoological facility with science and conservation education at its root. And it wasn't that then. They had to figure out this was where we wanted to go. But I knew if we could turn it, we were a San Diego Zoo in the making. Not as big, but in many ways as good. And lo and behold, I was given the opportunity to take it in that direction. Because when they gave me the zoo to run, it was a tabula rasa. And they would have done anything to support me if I just stopped the bleeding. That's what I was really hired to do. And I did a lot better than that. I surprised them all.
You look at a place like Memphis or St. Louis or lots of cities approximately in the Atlanta League. Why did you think Atlanta had some unique advantages?
Well, several things. First of all, they were all the primates because it had the primate center and it had all the institutions that had primates in it. Every university I just mentioned, primatologists of some note. Dwayne Rumbaugh over at Georgia State, a great figure in the business. And by the way, a man who worked at the San Diego Zoo at one time. There were many others, and they were all there to guide this young primatologist. And that was a sense of inspiration. But it's also the fact that Atlanta was beginning to be the hot city in the South. It was entrepreneurial to a fault. And there were people like Ted Turner that thought they could do anything. So when you're surrounded by people like that, and of course, you know, I met this guy named Newt Gingrich, and first thing he told me is, I'm going to be Speaker of the House someday. And I thought, you know, I didn't say it to you at the time, but I thought, good God, how's that ever going to happen?
Yeah. Well, it took me longer than it took you.
But you thought big, and people who think big, you know, I knew that if I thought big enough and was able to work for it and do the right things, we'd get it, and we did.
So, I mean, one of your first big breakthroughs was convincing the Ford Motor Company to provide a remarkable facility. How did you pull that off?
Well, it's interesting because Ford had had a plant in Atlanta for 75 years, but their marketers told them nobody knew it. Nobody really knew that Ford had contributed anything in the city. So their marketers were trying to uplift the image of Ford Motor Company. So they were shopping their involvement to try to fix something or advance something that would be noticed. So they came around and they looked at the zoo, asked me to tell them what I was doing there that might be remarkable. Now I said to them, you know, I've got an idea for you. We're going to build the best gorilla exhibit in the entire world. And we're starting with one gorilla. And I said, I know we can do this if we have the support for community, but we're going to need funding. And if we had a partner like Ford, it would make it so much easier. So having sketched out the vision to them, they went back to the drawing board, thought about it, and decided, you know, let's take that zoo on. Let's make that our project. They came back. But I always remember when Jim Donaldson, who was one of their marketing guys, gave me the first check for $50,000. He whispered in my ear as I was about to walk out and give a speech. He said, "Now, Terry," he had a sort of a Scottish brogue. "Now, Terry, it better not be number two." And they always told me, and this is another thing I learned from Ford, they weren't the biggest automaker in the world, but they thought they were the best. So from the very beginning, I used to preach to my staff, you don't have to be big to be great. You only have to be great. And to me, being great is being smart. Having smart people, solving problems, doing things the right way, and doing things far beyond the norm. And we learned that from organizations like Ford.
Well, and you had a remarkable access to gorillas that nobody else could really compete with. At its peak, how many total gorillas were in the exhibit?
Well, at the time we were trying to get gorillas, we just had Willie B, but we were going to try to get 3 breeding groups. And we ended up getting, as I recall, 10 or 11 gorillas, about a half a dozen orangutans. And from the very day we put them outside in the new facility, they began to breed. So it was very quickly becoming what I had envisioned as a population of gorillas. No zoo had ever exhibited a population before. They'd exhibit at most a group, maybe 2 groups, but never a population, many groups. We built 5 habitats, and one of them was a single small habitat right in the middle for Willie B, because we had no idea whether Willie B was going to ever be anything but a solitary gorilla. But we had a thought that we'd give him a chance. By the way, I just wrote a book about Willie B. That book is going to be published probably in August. And it's the whole story of how Willie B became the great social gorilla, the great parent, 5 offspring. And everybody thought he was a dud, but he turned out to be the most wonderful social gorilla.
How many years had he been in isolation?
He was born in Africa, captured there. He had been at the zoo since 1959. And then it took another 10, 11, 12 years to build the exhibit. So he was a singleton gorilla all that time, about 27 years. And later on, when he became a social gorilla, you would have never imagined that animal could have ever been normal.
Huh.
Because the theoreticians, people like Harlow, had discovered that when you were socially deprived or isolated long enough, you developed behaviors that made it impossible for you to be normal. But he had skills, whether his mother and the group with his mother had somehow inoculated him with enough awareness, or whether it was the early experience with his keepers. I don't know what happened to make that gorilla a social gorilla, but by God, when he saw other gorillas, he warmed up to them. And I remember the first day he copulated. It was one of the biggest days of my life. I just couldn't believe we'd succeeded.
How long did that take from the time he met his first gorilla to being intimate?
Just a couple of months.
Huh. He was able to break through the decades of isolation pretty quickly.
Well, that's right. I don't think he really knew what to do, but the females did. And the females sort of sidled up. They liked him. Every one of those females at that zoo that came over from Yerkes liked Willie B. They used to come up to the edge of their enclosures looking at him. And we all knew that he was attractive. And they had silverback males in the group, but they'd rather be with Willie. So when we finally put a group together for Willie, boy, I mean, he had a harem like unbelievable. I mean, they all liked him so much, and the little kids liked him, and they played on him, and he let them take food from him. He was amazing. That's the story I wrote, was how he had transformed himself. I give him the credit.
That book will be out this summer.
Yeah, it'll be out probably in August.
One of the books you introduced me to was Franz de Waal's Chimpanzee Politics.
Yeah.
Which opens with a male gorilla who had been bullying these 2 females until they decided to form a team. And then he had to be rescued by the keepers because they were going to kill him if they didn't get him out of the way. As a practicing politician, I found de Waal's book on chimpanzee politics just amazingly helpful. And a reminder of why it's worthwhile, I think, for people to always have an opening to the world of wild animals and the world of systems that are beyond concrete and beyond what we live in every single day. And I think, if I remember correctly, you actually introduced me to Franz at one point, and We had a good chat.
Yeah, he's a remarkable man. He came down and gave a speech here for our first Charles Darwin birthday lecture that I set up with the University of North Florida. And it was a brilliant speech. He is a remarkable guy. I met him when he was a graduate student in Holland. And I was very impressed with him. Of course, he became such a great, prolific writer. But it is true, if you know primatology, you understand human behavior much better than most people. For example, what happens when a leader falls? Chaos ensues. It always does. And sometimes when this happens in humanity, people are surprised, but I'm always leaning back and saying, well, I could have predicted that.
Yeah.
And the things that you said, coalitions and things that happen with the primates, they're predictors of what we do. We're a lot like them.
But in a way, if I could just explore this with you for a minute, because you're so amazingly knowledgeable about it. There are significant differences between gorillas, chimpanzees, gibbons, orangutans, and how they interacted and how they sort of keep score with life. I mean, so in a sense, you can learn something from each one of them, although I would guess that we're probably more like chimpanzees and gorillas than we are like orangutans and gibbons. That's my highly unprofessional observation.
Well, certainly. There's no singular primate model that answers every question, but genetically, we're more similar to chimpanzees than any other species. Gorillas are close. Bonobos are close. Orangutans a little more distant, but they all have very big brains, but they have different social systems. The gorilla lives in family groups. Chimpanzee lives in large aggregations. Orangutans are semi-solitary. Gibbons and Siamongs, the so-called lesser apes, are monogamous. They are one of the very few primates that's truly monogamous. So all of these things are out there telling us that somehow we evolved with a little bit different way of behaving, but they were pressures that made us who we are in the same way they evolved. And in many ways, the big brain is what really separates humans from all the other primates. And physiologists have determined that the human brain shouldn't be as big as it is. If you looked at the primates in some kind of phylogenetic order, they line up as a beautiful regression line until you get to humans. And then it jumps up. Something happened with humans. I won't speculate on what that is, but it has something to do with religion. We're certainly different in that respect.
Chris and I had a tiny taste of your life a few years back. We went to Rwanda and went up to about 9,000 feet on the mountain that Jane Fossey had been on, and actually got to see a fairly large family of gorillas. And when you're out there in the wild, it is amazing just the impact psychologically that they have, and also how relatively unaggressive they are if you don't get too close to them. I mean, they don't see you as a threat, and they don't particularly want to go out and threaten you.
Well, it's hard to believe that people used to think that they were very dangerous creatures that had to be hunted and feared. Gargantua, the gorilla, was an example of that, King Kong. But nothing could be further from the truth when you go and see real gorillas. Now, they will fight, they'll defend themselves if they need to. The silverback male is very impressive, but when they're there in that little group, it's the most peaceful thing you'll ever see. And I'm glad you had that privilege, because it really is a privilege to sit among mountain gorillas and enjoy their company.
You know, I'm very impressed, Terry. I don't have your range of experience, but I've been in zoos in a number of countries, and consistently they are a magnet for families with young children. And it's just astonishing. You know, you'll see people with babies in baby carriages or in strollers, and it's clear that going to the zoo is one of the things that they do regularly, and that they get something out of just the experience of being in that kind of an environment.
Yeah, families, you know, they're our number one target market. At the same time, those zoos are becoming more inclusive. They're beginning to reach out to all populations. There are more and more young people who don't want to have children, I'm sorry to say, and they need places to go as well. So we are beginning to understand that the diversity of humans with all their different needs and interests and tendencies, they need zoos too. I've seen zoos doing remarkable things to cater to all segments of society, and particularly the minority communities, which have not been the target of zoos in the past, in part because zoos were attempting to build strong financial connections with these communities. So they saw the wealthier suburbs as the place to raise money and spent more time tending to those places. This got the zoo in Atlanta in trouble. And by the way, just a small technical detail, the Zoological Society never got the zoo. They wanted it. But because they were, quote, lily white and not diverse, Mayor Young and the others in the city that decided to change things, decided to build a new board. And this board is one of the things that made Atlanta unique. The society stayed as a support group, and they were very important. But the wisdom of our board was it was gender balanced. It was balanced for ethnicity. You know, in Atlanta, it's primarily black, white was the issue then. And I think probably one of the first nonprofits in Atlanta that was built that way. And at the same time, the city said, we're giving this to the private business sector. We're not going to run the zoo anymore, but we will accept a public-private partnership. Down the line, when you need bonding, we'll be there for you. But we're not going to take the credit, and we're not going to take the blame for what happens to the zoo anymore. It's up to you, Bob Holder, and some of these business people that took over. So the private sector, the society, and the business community, they stepped up. But it was a remarkable partnership. I talk about it a lot in my new book. It's kind of amazing that the corporate, government, and academic communities came together on this thing and found common ground. And Newt, I think you know, because we've talked about this, Zoo Atlanta was the first zoo in AZA to privatize. And that trend has now spread all over the country. Most zoos are some kind of public-private partnership. Very few of them are run by government alone.
I mean, you're an enormous pioneer. In fact, you have written extensively, and on our show page, we're going to list your current books, and we're also going to pre-list your upcoming book on Willie B, so people will be able to get it. And I hope sometime we can come back together again as old friends. I want to get you just to talk about animals. I mean, I love animals. I think we have a lot of folks who love animals, and you have some amazing stories and a depth of knowledge that's pretty remarkable. And you're a great citizen, both for the country and, frankly, for the wildlife that we have to have a positive strategy of trying to sustain. So, Terry, I want to thank you. This has been remarkable. And even though I've known you for, over 40 years, I know you a lot better after this conversation.
Well, Newt, it's a pleasure.
Thank you to my guest, Dr. Terry Maple. You can read more about why zoos matter on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan. And our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Pendley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.